702, the Midday Report with Mandy Wiener.
Live, streaming countrywide.
On the Prime Media Plus app.
DStv Channel 856.
92.7.
And 106 FM.
On the show today, former President Jacob Zuma loses another bid to get Billy Dana removed from his corruption case. Two brothers appear in an Eswatini court in connection with the AKA murder. Inflation is up. Phone lines are still down at 11 Gauteng hospitals. And the Minister of Water meets the city of Joburg over ongoing water concerns. All of that over the next hour.
702.
Let's walk the talk.
Good afternoon. Welcome to the Midday Report on 702 and Cape Talk with me, Mandy Wiener. We'll get into all of those court cases in a minute, but Stats SA releasing inflation figures, and it really is a concern to any potential hopes we may have had around an interest rate cut next week, because the annual consumer price inflation is up to 5.6% in February. That's from 5.3% in January, the second consecutive increase and the highest since October last year. Much worse than expected. Economists were expecting it, well, not much worse. Economists were expecting it to go to 5.5% and it's at 5.6%. So that obviously is a concern. At the same time, News 24 has just put out a story to say that civil servants, it's now been confirmed, will receive a 4.7% salary hike from April the 1st. That's according to the Department of Public Service and Administration. And this is in line with a two-year wage deal signed by a narrow majority of public sector trade unions in March last year. The inflation number for the wage increase is based on the projected consumer price inflation, according to News 24. So annual consumer price inflation rising to 5.6%. So sorry, it doesn't look like a rate cut is going to happen next week. All right, let's go to the courts now. And as you heard leading the Eyewitness News Bulletin, that decision in the matter of the former president, Jacob Zuma. Remember, the Pietermaritzburg High Court handing down judgment on this application, the second application by Zuma to remove Billy Dana from the arms deal corruption case, and judgment being handed down by Judge Nkosinathi Chili earlier today and dismissing Zuma's application. Have a listen.
Mr. Zuma's application is anchored in what he terms in his founding affidavit, four pillars, paraphrased as follows. Pillar one, the private prosecution of Mr. Dana by Mr. Zuma. Pillar two, allegations of disclosure of Mr. Zuma's confidential and private information, including Mr. Zuma's health condition, to Ms. Mohn. Pillar three, allegations of disclosure of information pertaining to Mr. Zuma's prosecution to Mr. Soul, and Pillar 4, an averment that Mr. Dana is not indispensable. Having had regard to submissions made by counsel, the relevant case law, and most importantly, the four pillars relied upon by Mr. Zuma, I am not persuaded that Mr. Zuma succeeded in establishing that the retention of Mr. Dana as the prosecutor in this matter could prejudice his right to a fair trial enshrined in Section 35, subsection 3 of the Constitution. I therefore make the following order. The application for the removal of Mr. Dana as the public prosecutor in the criminal prosecution of Mr. Zuma and Thales South Africa Pty Ltd. is dismissed. Reasons shall be incorporated in my judgment.
Judge Nkosinathi Chili handing down that judgment earlier today. Of course, Advocate Dali Mpofu saying that there will be an application for leave to appeal and arguing that the corruption trial cannot go ahead until this appeal is finalised. Bernadette Wicks, EWN reporter, joining us now. Bernadette, good afternoon to you. Let's first start with the decision to dismiss the application. What were the grounds given by Judge Chili? Are those clear yet?
Yet, Mandy, they're not clear yet at all, Mandy. He did indicate that he will provide these reasons when he hands down his final judgment at the end of the trial. So we don't know exactly what his sort of line of reasoning is at this point. All we do know is that Zuma, unfortunately, for him, failed to persuade the court that his fair trial rights were really in jeopardy with Billy Downer staying on the case.
So what theoretically should happen now? Does the corruption trial go ahead?
Theoretically, yes, the corruption trial should go ahead. And we must remember that technically we are actually in the trial phase of proceedings because the former president and Antales have both pleaded formally to the charges. And traditionally, that signals the start of the trial phase. What should happen now is that we start with the leading of evidence. But as you mentioned, Advocate Mpofu has indicated that they already have instructions to appeal this ruling, and how that could possibly hold up proceedings further still kind of remains to be seen at this point.
Okay. So where do we go next then? Because there is an application for leave to appeal. So how does this play out?
Yeah, so the case has now been postponed until the 17th of May, and that's for a pre-trial conference. Now, the state did push very much for the matter to be postponed for trial to go ahead, and they spoke at length about the delays that have already been experienced in this matter and how important it is that we actually get to the substance and to the merits of this case now. But what Advocate Mpofu said is that he needs time to consult with his legal team, and so instead they kind of met in the middle and decided that they would postpone for pre-trial conference, like I say, the 17th of May. So there should be some more clarity at that point on how this matter is actually going to proceed forward. But my own personal view would be that I do think there's a good chance that once the appeal is lodged, that it could potentially sort of halt proceedings in the criminal matter again. And I think like with the former president's other application, we can expect this to go all the way to the Constitutional Court, whichever way it goes. So I do suspect that there are probably still some more delays on the cards in this matter, but we will have to wait and see.
Bernadette Wicks, thank you very much. EWN reporter following that court case today. The application, the second application by the former president, Jacob Zuma, to have Billy Downer removed as the prosecutor, failing. And the irony here, of course, is this is Stalingrad. This is exactly what Jacob Zuma has been doing for years in Advocate Dali Mpofu. And again, delays. This will knock it down until well after the elections, conveniently for former President Jacob Zuma, who's now campaigning for the MK party. But even so, the fact that we are now in the trial stage of this, and that trial stage is just not happening because evidence is not being led, because there's now going to be an appeal and it will go all the way up to the Constitutional Court. And this is exactly what the courts have been criticizing. It is an abuse of the court process.
702. Mandy Wiener.
Weekdays, 12 to 1 p.m.
Well, speaking of an abuse of the court process, you would have heard in the EWN bulletin, the judge in the Senzo Meyiwa trial, very unhappy with some bad lawyers. Well, let's find out about that with Khumotso Madise, EWN reporter. Khumotso, good afternoon to you. Thank you for your time. Some consternation in court about lawyers being bad and not being present. Just talk us through what happened there.
Good afternoon, Mandy. So we were expecting proceedings to go ahead today with at least two or three of the state witnesses that had been scheduled to continue testifying on the confession statements. But on Monday, what we had heard from the lawyer for the first accused, Tulani Ngomozulu, was that they're not available, or he was asking for some time to familiarize himself with parts of the main trial that he didn't know or hadn't been privy to because he wasn't present at the beginning of the main trial. The court then on that day, I remember Judge Ratamokhwakeng saying, you know, not buying it really, saying, you know, he knows all the tricks in the book. And he then allowed and afforded him an opportunity to go through what he wanted to. And that's why we didn't have court proceedings in the Meyiwa trial yesterday. Today, however, Tulani Ngomozulu, lawyer for the first accused, was a no-show. He didn't come to court at all. And we heard from State Advocate George Baloyi that the reason why he couldn't come is because the matter that he was attending to yesterday had gone on for longer than he thought it would go on for. And so he wasn't available. Ngomozulu then made a call to the lawyer for the fifth accused, that is Zandile Mshololo, the advocate Zandile Mshololo, to tell him that, tell her that he would not be in court, asking that the lawyer for the second accused, Sipora Mosepele, to stand in for him. And this has all been told to Judge Lata Mokgwatleng, who was very unhappy about this. I mean, Judge Mokgwatleng first questioning why Mgomezulu didn't bother calling him or his clerk to let him know that he wouldn't be coming to court, but also pointing out how there's an expectation from Mgomezulu that Ramosepele would stand in for him, even though Ramosepele was fired by accused number one just 2 weeks ago, who took on Mgomezulu as his final lawyer, saying how would anyone expect that to happen when Ramosepele was fired by this very accused. But I think another important part was when he asked the question, is this how lawyers, or maybe I should say, and be honest about it, black lawyers conduct themselves in the court? And I think at that point, then, it was then up to the state to decide whether proceedings continue or not.
What happened?
Well, they did continue. They were very, very brief, Mandy. We had two of the witnesses who took the stand, who had previously been on the stand. It was the interpreter, Evelyn, Tepiso Evelyn Mutabing, who is the interpreter who was present when Moani Ndanzi signed the confession statement. Of course, she had to testify because she was part of that process. And then there was also the police officer who was part of the pointings out process that was done by the first accused. Now, the only reason why the two had to come and testify now is because the defense did not want the evidence from the trial within the trial to be automatically injected into the main trial. And that's why we're seeing all these witnesses coming back on the witness stand, even though their testimonies are very brief. So those two testimonies, Mandy, have been completed today, and we're going to wait for another testimony on Friday before a way forward is determined.
Khumotso Modise, thank you very much for that, Khumotso, giving us an update there on the Senzo Meyiwa trial and a rebuke from the judge in that matter for some of the lawyers in that case.
702, The Midday Report, Monday to Friday,
12 to 1 p.m.
Two men arrested in Eswatini for the murders of Kienan, a.k.a. Forbes, and Dibelo Tibbs Motswane, appearing in the Manzini Magistrates Court today. The brothers Siyabonga and Malusi Ndumande were arrested by the Royal Eswatini Police Service last month. Their brother Dandani was also arrested in KwaZulu-Natal. Let's go to Newsroom Africa reporter Mweli Masilela, who is following the story. Mweli, good afternoon to you. Thank you very much for making time to speak to us here on the Midday Report. Tell us about this court appearance today.
Good afternoon to you, Mandy, and the listeners. I can tell you that it was indeed a very brief court appearance. Quite a few matters discussed, but the key among those is the fact that for the first time we heard about the state confirming that they officially received the extradition, the comprehensive extradition document on the 18th of March, and that is something that was also confirmed by the defense represented by Sivesonke Ngwenya, representing the two, that is Malusi and Siyabonga. But I can tell you that the state was ready to proceed with the matter of extradition today. Unfortunately, on the side of the defense, in fact, it's a matter that they've made it very clear, even from the very beginning, that they won't proceed with this application until they have a thorough look into those extradition documents, which they confirmed that they have received. So it's a very huge document, Mandy, considering the fact that it's about 254 pages. So they've asked the court that they need time to go through those documents so that they can be able to make a decision whether to oppose the extradition or not. And that's why then the matter was postponed to the 9th. So on the 9th, we will know from the side of the defense if indeed they are done with perusing those documents, and then the decision thereof that they will take to say they are opposing or not, Mandy. But another matter that came up was that of the exhibit, the four cell phones. I think you'll remember about those. There was a provisional detention order that was issued by the magistrate. So that court order has been extended up until the next court appearance.
Mweli, on this issue of the extradition, we spoke to Crispin Peary yesterday, the Minister of Justice's spokesperson. I asked how long he thought it would take, whether they thought that this would be quite a swift process. When you're in the courtroom and listening to that process and watching it unfold before you, what sense do you get? Do you think we are going to wait a very long time for this extradition to be finalised, or is it hard to tell?
It's very tricky because you'll remember even the first time when the case started, we're expecting that those documents will be availed in court soon, and we had to wait ever since because these they are law processes, as we have heard also from the Minister of Justice and Correctional Services, Ronald Lamola, that after the arrest, there is that 30 days period allowing giving space for the state to finish those documents. So even with the extradition process, it's likely to take long, especially if they say, if the defense comes up on the 9th to say that they are opposing. In fact, today I asked them, what are those elements that will actually make them decide to oppose the extradition? They said no comment on that until they read that document. So after they're done, even if they say that if they say that they are actually opposing, then they'll have to make submissions in court. That's only when we'll be able to have a clear picture as to why they are opposing, because in court they have to motivate why are they actually opposing, because we know that even before they raised issues of safety to say that they want the state to make sure that the two are safe as they return to South Africa. In fact, there was even a suggestion to say that they would want those two to be handed over to prison officials rather than being handed over to the South African Police Service. So those are elements that will come up, especially on the 9th. That's in case they oppose. But if they don't oppose, then it will be an agreement between both parties, that is the state and the defense, and then the extradition process will take off, and there shouldn't be any problems. But if they oppose, that process will take long, I can tell you.
Mweli, thank you very much. Mweli Masilela, Newsroom Africa reporter, with that update from the Manzini Magistrates Court, where two men who were arrested in Eswatini for the murders of AKA and Tibbs have appeared in court there briefly, and now a delay until the 9th of April as we await that extradition process.
702. Mandy Wiener.
Weekdays, 12 to 1 p.m.
12:24 on the Midday Report with me, Mandy Wiener. Of course, we have been telling you at length about the water situation in Johannesburg over the past few weeks. Well, the Minister of Water and Sanitation, Senzo Mkunu, together with the deputy ministers, last night met with the leadership of the city of Joburg, led by the executive mayor, Kabelo Gwamanda, to receive an update on the plans to deal with the current water challenges. Let's get an update on that from the Deputy Director General at the Department of Water, Dr. Risimati Matie. Doctor, good afternoon to you. Thank you very much for your time today. What was the sense from the ministry and the water officials around how Joburg has been dealing with this water crisis over the past couple of weeks and the plan going forward?
Yes, Mandy, thank you for having us. As you may have known, on the 5th, the department is the one that led the conversation when the minister called in the mayor and the team, where we presented to them our findings in the entire city of Joburg. We went region per region, identifying some of those gaps in the sustainability of the water provision. And we then asked them to go prepare a response on the action plans they are planning to put in place and also which ones are a priority to implement. So the meeting you just cited now was basically a follow-up which the minister called in the mayor and the team. Now, in their presentation, what came out clear was that they do have some of the plans specifically that talks to much of their reservoir storage capacities, which most of them are not functional. They also spoke of plans to reduce the water losses, which we are also pleading with the communities on the use of water. But what came out quite clear, Mindy, it's actually much of the financial constraints which the city is basically subjected to at the moment, which basically prevents them to ring fence the reinvestment of their revenue, even from the grants that get allocated to their infrastructure. So they're basically on a deficit in numbers of about 26 billion or so in the next couple of years to keep up with the infrastructure upgrade and renewal as we match in the population dynamics in the city.
And according to your statement, DDG, as you mentioned, the infrastructure backlog estimated at around 27 million rand. So attention is now being turned to possible private sector funding. So is there a sense now that the city just simply does not have enough money to deal with this infrastructure issue, and they need to look at public-private partnerships?
You see, water, in essence, mainly, is supposed to be self-financing as a sector. So when people pay for water, it affords the city to invest back into the system. But the 26 billion, which is a deficit, this has actually been accumulating over a period of time where the infrastructure renewal was not happening. And as you know, if you take time to renew some of the infrastructure, when you talk time value of money in future, it will basically cost you more than it will cost you now. So as the prices get escalated years over years, the city has actually been replacing less infrastructure, investing less in the sector. Now, talking on the private sector investment, when you look at the economics of scale, City of Joburg has got huge potential, specifically on the effluent reuse of storage water, water conservation, and water demand management, where the private sector actually has the appetite. So it's a space where even the department has established a water partnership office where we are encouraging municipalities to at least unlock the private sector investment in the form of maybe performance contract where they can invest and get their money back. But this helps to at least accelerate the pipe replacement and infrastructure upgrade. So that is an area which City of Joburg is basically looking at, and the department is really assisting the city to look through this together with National Treasury.
On the most recent issues and what's been happening at Akenhof over the past couple of weeks and the knock-on effect of that, according to the statement, the ministers urged the city to work on its turnaround time in response to pipe bursts and leaks. But just general in terms of Akenhof and what's been happening there, is the minister and the department satisfied with how the supply has been restored?
To begin with, we were not happy with the more or less collapse of the system where people spent a couple of days without water. So the minister was quite clear that that is not something that we are happy with. However, he did commend the fact that the city does have some plans and the energy from the city should be to finance some of those, to restructure some of their budget to invest in the water sector. When you talk the Akenhof system, yes, there was an issue of lightning which struck one of the power stations there, which supplies electricity to one of the pump stations there. So the effect started from there. And when the system was recovering, it took time for it to recover. There was another lightning or so. As you know, City of Joburg, to be specifically, is one of the highly pressurized systems. So it takes time for it to pick up. And then there was another downtime in the middle, which had another negative bearing with the communities. But the city did assure us that they're working on a plan, and the system is starting to recover now as we speak.
Dr. Risimati Mache, DDG at Water Services at the Department of Water and Sanitation, thank you very much for your time and for explaining that, reflecting on that meeting last night between the Minister of Water, water officials and the City of Joburg and the Executive Mayor.
And now it's back to Mandy Wiener on the Midday Report.
This is 702.
Let's walk the talk.
12:36 on the Midday Report. The Department of Trade, Industry and Competition is holding the second Black Industrialists and Exporters Conference. It's taking place at the Sandton Convention Center in partnership with the Industrial Development Corporation and the National Empowerment Fund. The Minister of Trade, Industry and Competition, Ibrahim Patel, saying considerable strides have been made to establish Black Industrialists in the country since the program was introduced in 2016. Black industrialists in industries like pharmaceuticals, automotive components and energy have emerged, creating employment opportunities. The minister was giving a keynote at that conference in Sandton. So let's get the latest now with 702's business correspondent, Moteo Juaripe, who's covering the conference for us. Moteo, it's been 8 years since the government launched the Black Industrialist Program. Are there any successes thus far?
Well, thank you, Mandy. Yes, Minister of Trade and Industry and Competition, Ibrahim Patel, sharing some of those successes that have come from this particular program. Now, through its development finance institutions like the Industrial Development Corporation and the National Empowerment Fund, government has funded over 1,000 black industrialists, disbursing around 36.7 billion rand to them over the past 8 years. Now, some 200 black industrialists representing more than 10 billion rand in turnover will be exhibiting at this particular conference, the Black Industrialists and Exporters Conference, the second one of its kind. And I'm joined now by the incentives manager in terms of this particular program, Susan Mangole, acting DDG incentives for the Black Industrialist Program. Can you share some of the successes that have come from the past 8 years running this program?
Thank you so much. When we look back, we were targeting about 100 black industrialists, but by now we are on over 1,000 black industrialists that are employing almost 100,000 of South Africans. These black industrialists are actually contributing almost 80 billion annually to the GDP of the country.
Then, looking at some of the challenges that have been faced by the black industrialists, we know of late, it's the structural challenges that South Africa has in terms of the ports challenges, the logistical challenges, but also Eskom through consistent power supply. What are some of those things that you're hoping to iron out for the industrialists so that they could scale their businesses?
One of the key things that we want to iron up today, we brought the procurers, the buyers. We want them to open their books for the black industrialists to make sure that they give them orders for market access. As well as through the African trade, we are allowing them to go to Africa and make sure that they explore. The reason we brought 200 products here of black industrialists is to show the buyers that they must play those orders. Then in terms of the other structural issues, we are providing support through other measures of financial support.
Well, as you've heard there, Mandy, from Susan Mangole, acting DDG of incentives for this particular program, they're looking to collaborate the private sector as well as the black industrialists in making sure that there is sustainable businesses going forward and sustainable deals that can be cut at this particular conference. But we'll keep giving you all the updates that are coming out from this particular conference, hoping to get some word from the industrialists themselves and the businesses they've built over the years.
Mateo, thank you very much. Mateo Juaripe, 702's business reporter there at the Department of Trade, Industry and Competition, presenting the second Black Industrialists and Exporters Conference taking place today at the Sandton Convention Centre in partnership with the Industrial Development Corporation and the National Empowerment Fund.
702.
The Midday Report with Mandy Wiener.
Let's walk the talk.
Well, let's go to Parliament now, because a race against the clock, because Parliament needs to finalise the Electoral Matters Amendment Bill. We've been speaking about this. There have been threats from a broad band of opposition parties to go to court if the NCOP does not remove amendments related to the funding formula. The Select Committee on Security and Justice meeting today to finalise those deliberations. Lindsay Dentlinger, EWN reporter, with the latest on that. Lindsay, good afternoon to you. What has the Committee on Security and Justice been discussing today?
Good afternoon, Mandy. Well, a very swift meeting that lasted less than half an hour. Essentially, the upshot is they won't be making any amendments to this bill as it was received from the National Assembly, and neither will they be heeding to calls from these opposition parties that you've mentioned to remove these aspects that relate to the funding of how political parties get funded from the state. As we know, this bill was primarily to make provision for independent candidates to declare their funding sources in the same way that political parties do, but opposition parties saying that the ANC are trying to push through a whole bunch of other amendments that relate to the funding of political parties, the limits of the donations that they may receive, the declarations, the thresholds for those declarations, of those donations that they receive, all things in their view that are not necessary at this time. And essentially what they are saying is a money grab attempt, Mandy, by the ANC to get more money into their coffers ahead of the election.
And obviously, as I mentioned, there is a deadline here. There's a clock ticking. So what happens from here, and is this likely to get finished in time?
Well, it will be passed by the National Council of Provinces. I would predict after today's meeting, probably be on the order paper as soon as next week. They've moved very quickly. They only got this bill from the National Assembly on the 12th of March, and we are already on the 20th. Within 8 days, they've decided to make no changes. They conducted a parallel public participation process, which is also a sticking point that political parties say they will challenge. And so I don't foresee it not being passed by Parliament in time for the elections. It's what happens next, Mandy, which is the concern. A press conference already held in Parliament yesterday by these opposition parties saying that if this bill is then approved by the National Council of Provinces as soon as next week or even the week thereafter, they will go to court to challenge these provisions, which they believe are unnecessary and more importantly, extremely unfair in their view. ANC could stand to gain as much as 50 million rand, Mandy, ahead of these elections if they change the funding formula, which political parties say is unconstitutional and flies in the face of previous judgments by the highest court in the land about the equitable distribution of funds across political parties represented in Parliament.
And we know also, of course, that the ANC really does need that 50 million rand because they have struggled in the past to pay salaries, and it is an election year, of course. Lindsay Dentlinger, thank you very much for that, speaking to us there from Parliament on that issue around getting that bill passed before the elections.
702. 702. Mandy Wiener.
Weekdays, 12 to 1 p.m.
Every week we've been bringing you Tidi Madia, the Associate Politics Editor at EWN's podcast, Politricking. This week, Tidi speaks to the ATM leader, Vuyo Zungula. And of course, Vuyo Zungula has and the ATM have really made a name for themselves in terms of their legal challenge around the public protector, the office of the public protector, the former public protector, should I say, Busisiwe Mkhwebane. And one of the questions Tidi did ask Vuyo Zungula was about his thoughts on the former public protector joining the EFF and now being an MP. Take a listen to what he had to say.
And then the other thing that I found really interesting is I watched Advocate Busisiwe Mkhwebane. I don't think anybody fought as hard as you did for her throughout that period of the inquiry, throughout a lot of the issues that she was dealing with the head of state, and with the courts. I really felt that you were a strong voice advocating for the Advocate Mkhwebane. Were you surprised at all to see her taking up a red beret and not coming to ATM? I really would have thought that if I sat down and I thought about it, if you fought hardest for me, I should be feeling safer that in that space. Were you surprised at all about her decision to go towards the red berets?
We actually never recruited her. Like, I think she made a press conference whereby she says a lot of parties approached her. We never approached her because when we were defending the office of the public protector, we were not defending so that we can gain membership from her. We're doing it from a principal point of view. And when she decided that she's going to join a certain party, for us, we did not feel betrayed because we were not doing it in the first place for anything that is going to give material gain to us as a party. We're doing it for the best interests of the country.
That's Vuyo Zungula, the ATM leader, speaking to Tidi Madia on Politricking. You can go listen to the full interview on primemediaplus.com or on any of the podcast streaming services.
702.
702.
Mandy Wiener.
Weekdays, 12 to 1 p.m.
12:48 on the Midday Report with me, Mandy Wiener. We've spoken about electricity. We spoke about water. What is the situation with phone lines at the Department of Health? Because there were reports that many Department of Health facilities in Gauteng, you couldn't phone them because their numbers weren't working. So at things stand at the moment, a total of 11 hospitals do not have functioning phone lines and adequate channels of communication, which, of course, impacts a lot of people. And this is apparently due to outstanding payments by the Department of Health. So Telkom took a decision to disconnect phone lines of 83 clinics and 32 hospitals. Well, let's get clarity on this now with Motale Tale Modiba, who's the Gauteng Health spokesperson. Motale Tale, good afternoon to you. Thank you very much for your time. Firstly, the cause of this, is this because the bills were not paid, so Telkom cut off the lines? Is that accurate?
Let me start by correcting and saying it's 11 facilities that are affected. as we speak. And then secondly, the issue has got to do with a dispute that we have with Telkom. The same way as when you get your billing monthly, you go through your itemized billing, you look at it, and obviously if there are things that are not making sense on that statement, you obviously would query that with your service provider. So in this instance, we had things that we were querying where we had facilities that don't exist within the Gauteng Department of Health portfolio of buildings that we were querying, say, but which facility is this and which one is this and this, before we pay, because you because it's public funds, you don't just pay without first double checking and so forth. So we couldn't find each other with Telkom. They are applying a rule that says pay and then you can query later. And we've been to and fro, obviously, with regard to that. So we've taken a decision now of saying we will pay, we're going to query, but not only that, we are also with the process of migrating so that we move from this current system that we're currently working on, which we think is a bit more expensive for us, and we're migrating. Most of our facilities now have migrated into a new system, which is operated by the eGov, which is from a cost point of view, it's much less. So the issue here is a dispute that we had lost with them in terms of some of the itemized matters that are on the bill that we were not we couldn't account for. We have already, by the way, if you recall the previous statement that we issued, we have already paid some monies in terms of previously, the things that we were able to clear, we have paid that. So it was just now what is remaining now in terms of the queries. But I think a decision has already been taken to say, in the interest of just continue service delivery, we will pay while we're settling this. But the long term is for us to move into a much more cheaper platform.
In terms of the 11 facilities that are still being affected, what is the status there and what do people do? And how soon do you think you can remedy that situation?
Okay, what we said yesterday when we were communicating that the 11 facilities that are still affected, we mentioned them, your Kisani Barra, your Charlotte Matlaike, Steve Biko, Pretoria West Hospital, Purusong Hospital, Jubilee, Vescopis, Far East Rand, Tara H. Moro Psychiatric Hospital, Tshwane District Hospital, and Carltonville Hospital. We have published alternative numbers. If you go to gauteng.gov.za, when you just enter that, already on the landing page, just it's right in front of you. You can't miss it. You just click on it. It gives you one list that has got all these different contact numbers. They are categorized that you can actually be able to see which number. So we've got alternative numbers within our facilities that we are utilizing for the different areas. So if you, for example, you were to go into that particular list and maybe say you want to get hold of Steve Biko, it will tell you the contact number of the CEO, the contact number of the various people that are responsible for the different areas, so that you are able to then interact with them.
Motale Tale, thank you very much. Motale Tale Modiba, Gauteng Health Spokesperson, giving us clarity there on what is happening with phone lines at health facilities in Gauteng.
702.
Let's walk the talk.
12:52. So if you were listening to the Midday Report yesterday at exactly this time, we did an interview with Africa Check about what politicians say about housing in this country. And the headline was how South Africa's top brass continue to inflate government housing figures and why it matters. And Africa Check, the reporter we spoke to, was drawing the distinction between housing opportunities and actual homes, and that politicians are often misleading on this point. The Human Settlements Minister, Mamoloko Kubai, has asked for right of reply on that. And of course, we're always interested in hearing both sides and allowing right of reply. So a pleasure to welcome the Human Settlements Minister, Mamoloko Kubai, to the Midday Report. Good afternoon, Minister, and thank you for getting in touch.
Good afternoon, Mandy, and good afternoon to your listeners. I did try to call in yesterday. I think the show was not allowing to call in because I thought it would have been important for me to correct on the platform at that time. But thank you for affording us this opportunity so that we can set the record straight.
Minister, what are your concerns around the Africa Check article? And my understanding is around the data that they are using. Is that your gripe?
Yes, correctly. One is that Africa Check, when they asked the department for information, we did request time so that we can give them information. Then they wrote the article first. Number two, we provided them and we offered them an opportunity to come and view our system, which we call it HSS, in terms of data. For example, yesterday he says that from their report, they know that we have provided houses to two million people, which is not correct. He says others is household. Actually, 2 million, it's only women beneficiaries who have been. We've got data. We've got name of beneficiaries that are not correct. Secondly, he said that in the interview yesterday that actually there is a possibility for somebody to double dip. It's not correct. No one can double dip in terms of beneficiaries. So when we account to say this is how many people have been, we have been able to check on our records based on an individual versus the ID number. And the person who gets a BNG is not a person that can get a certified. So there is no way that the person can double dip. Hence, even now, when we look at the issue of reviewing of our policy, for example, you'd remember that women organization had come through to us, raising concerns that women who come from families where they've been abused, they've been co-owning a house with a spouse, and then they get abused, they run away. When they come to us because they would appear as having previously been owners of a property, they get declined. And that's why we had to do a policy review in responding to those. And one of the issues is to try and see how best we ensure that the system does not get abused by those who are not facing the same challenges. Okay. So there is mechanisms in place, and that's what I found it strange that we actually offered AfricaCheck to come into our offices to look and verify the system. They did not take that up, but they continue to say our facts are not correct. And I don't know what is their basis when they've not even viewed our HSS system to be able to verify the figures.
Minister, the AfricaCheck report draws a distinction between houses and housing opportunities. And they are saying that the claim that you've made in Parliament that almost 4.8 million houses were provided for by government since 1996, that is not accurate, that it is misleading. Do you stand by that? Do you believe it is accurate?
I stand by that. We do not utilize housing opportunities as the Department of Human Settlements. Neither have we at any point talked about. If you look at our report, and even in terms of our MTSF, when we provide for a house, we talk about a house. When we provide for a service site, we talk about a service site as accounting. So there isn't a conflation of those two in terms of our reports.
They are arguing that you should be checking the HSS and report accurate housing figures and to highlight the difference between a house and a housing opportunity. Clearly, there's a disconnect here between the way that they are viewing this and the way that you're viewing it, which can happen with data.
They've never viewed HSS. HSS is human settlement system. So it's with us, as I'm saying, correctly so. I did tell them to say we are offering them to come and view our system. They have never come.
Minister, thank you. I hope that you do feel that you did have an opportunity to respond to the report.
Yes, I do. I do feel that because I just felt that it was incorrect in the manner that they did. But also would really appeal for colleagues. We've always been transparent. We welcome people, as I said. Those who would want to verify our information, we're very much willing to make that opportunity available. We respond to calls, to media inquiries, and would like to be offered an opportunity to also state our case so that we are not found ourselves in the back foot where people say things that are not correct about us without us being afforded the opportunity to say it.
Minister of Human Settlements, Mamoloko Kubai, thank you very much for your time responding to the interview yesterday. And I did tell you yesterday to go and read the AfricaCheck report. I still encourage you to go and do that. They have stated clearly that they did approach the minister for the details. And you can go and listen to this interview, go read the article. It's just more important, really, that we have the information and that we're able to clarify, particularly, as I said yesterday, in an election year, where data is going to be massaged in various ways. So make sure you're informed, make sure that you are educated about it.